This is the first day of this September-October 2013 seven-day session. And I'm going to read from a nice little volume that I've read from before called The Original Face. It's an anthology of Rinzai Zen. And I'm going to start with the last chapter, which are the words of Japanese Zen master Torii. I'll list a little bit here about Torii. He was the Dharma heir of Hakuin, which places him in the 18th and 19th century, 1721 to 1792. So he died during the early years of our republic. This anthology is translated and edited by Thomas Cleary, by the way. In this introduction, Cleary tells us that Torii, like Ananda of old, was first awakened as he began to lie down, exhausted and driven to distraction by his intense efforts in Zazen. Later he met Hakuin, but became desperately ill and had to be healed before continuing his work with Hakuin. Later, Torii, after he became a master, he wrote a detailed history of Zen and a study of the five houses of classical Zen in China. That's all we have for this master, Torii, Dharma heir of the great Hakuin. Now, these are his words. In what the Zen school calls ascending directly from the state of ordinary person to Buddhahood, there are five discriminations. One is the meaning of same nature. Second, the meaning of different paths. Third, the meaning of urgency. Fourth, the meaning of progressive practice. And fifth, the meaning of returning to the basis. This is the essential road. So these five. First, the meaning of same nature. The fundamental nature inherent in sentient beings is not other than the fundamental nature of all the Buddhas of the past, present, and future. Okay, of course, here he's talking about Buddha nature. Their range of powers and qualities are also equal, that is, between sentient beings and Buddhas. These are just conventional ways in Buddhist texts of referring to the so-called unenlightened and the enlightened, sentient beings and Buddhas. Their range of powers and qualities are also equal. Their lights are radiant. He's talking about everyone in this room and everyone not in this room. Their lights are radiant. Their knowledge, wisdom, and miraculous powers are all the same. This may be likened to the rays of the sun shining everywhere on the mountains, rivers, and plains, so nothing is not illumined. Nothing is not illumined. Gold and jewels are bright in themselves, even when they are in mud. However, blind people do not see, are not aware of this light, even though they are in its very midst. They are to be pitied. So here, this first of the four, the first of the five discriminations on this path, is what we just recited in the Hakuin Chant, right? How it begins and how it ends. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. And the very end, this very body, the body of Buddha. Don't think the body of Buddha is just shown on an altar or in paintings or prints. This, sitting on these mats and chairs, these are all the bodies of the Buddha. This is the bedrock of faith in Zen. That there ultimately there's nothing we need to do, nowhere we need to go, nothing we need to attain. This need to awaken to our self-nature, our true nature. So that was the same nature of all beings. The second is different paths. Here's the differentiation side, the other side of the matter. Although in their fundamental nature, Buddhas and sentient beings are the same substance, no different, the directions of their minds are different. Buddhas shine inward to illumine the basic mind, whereas sentient beings turn outward and get involved with myriad things. So this is one reason why we insist that people keep their eyes down during Sesshin and even outside Sesshin in the Zendo. So long as we are turned outward, then we will fail to see our own nature. Or at least it's harder. They have this thing in Theravada Buddhism called guarding the six sense gates. They're always talking about the sense gates, and these would be the six, what in Buddhism are called the six senses, the five of seeing, hearing, feeling, tasting, touching, smelling. Those five, and then the sixth being thinking or conceptualizing. And in Sesshin especially, we want to shut these down as much as possible, because so long as we are getting involved in sense objects, and that includes thoughts, that's the sixth sense object is thoughts, then we will be distracted from what is beyond the senses, beyond these five. At the same time, I don't want to go overboard and literally block the senses. We're not, you know, otherwise we would be, you know, putting earplugs in and anesthetizing the skin, and we wouldn't have teisho, because that's words that may bring something. So we're just doing what I think what is in balance, especially keeping the eyes down. So Buddhas shine inward to illumine the basic mind, whereas sentient beings turn outward and get involved with myriad things. This is these words that Roshi Kaplow used to like, the difference between centrifugal, using our energy in a centrifugal way, I mean scattering it, going outward, as compared to using it in a centripetal or ingathering way, which is what we're doing in Sesshin, certainly in Zazen. The idea is not to say there's anything wrong with looking outward. It's just we're trying to find some balance. Most people, their whole lives are outward oriented, and we're just trying to balance that with a more introspective orientation. That is why sentient beings create greed and lust for things they desire, anger and rage toward people they dislike, and become fools by becoming congealed in their thoughts. These are these three greed and lust, anger and rage, and then confusion. These are the three poisons. This is very basic stuff, but it is so fundamental. We create greed and lust for things we desire, and then for things we dislike, we generate anger and rage, hostility of all kinds. And then the first, delusion or confusion or folly, we become fools by becoming congealed in our thoughts. Confused and stupefied by these three poisons, they have lost their fundamental mind. So here, in the first point, same nature, he insists on the equality of all of us with Buddhas, with enlightened ones. And now here, he's saying, yes, but there's this other side where we misuse our minds in a way that Buddhas don't. Misdirect our attention. It's a lot of what Zen practice is, just learning how to have a conscious awareness of how we're directing our attention, because that will determine so much about the quality of our lives. And then he relates these three poisons to the six realms of unenlightened existence, sort of loosely. For example, those in whom greed and lust run deep turn into hungry ghosts. Those in whom anger and rage run deep become asuras. These are sometimes translated as fighting demons, fighting titans, anti-gods sometimes are called. This, in a psychological sense, I would see this as those who are fiercely into competition and power. They're seeing power as a zero-sum game, that you either have power over someone else or they have power over you. This is the orientation of an asura, A-S-U-R-A. So they traffic in anger and rage, and their habitual reactions of anger and rage are what condemn them or us to this asura existence. And then he takes the third one, delusion or folly. And those deep in folly and delusion become animals. Then he says, those in whom the three poisons are equal fall into hell and suffer various miseries. These are called the four bad dispositions, or the four lowest realms of the six unenlightened realms of existence. And then he takes the other two, the human realm and the realm of devas, or heavenly beings. And he goes on, even though they have greed, anger, and folly, those who restrain themselves and are not self-indulgent are human, and in this way will not lose this bodily form life after life. Those in whom greed, anger, and folly gradually quiet down and who are not self-indulgent, even though they don't restrain themselves, are born in heaven known as devas. It says here, gods of the six heavens of desire. I'm not going to get into that. So, for those who ever might wonder about our next lifetime, if you believe in rebirth, here he says that if we can lead our lives in a way that is not so disposed to be like hungry ghosts or animals, animal existences, or in delusion, then this is living as a human being in the true sense of the word. We know people who are animal-like, people who are ghost-like in their cravings. These are addicts of one kind or another, alcoholics, people chained to their attachments. The key thing about this is that none of these states is static. We change. We have the chance, depending on how we use this mind, we have the opportunity to move up these different realms, to get the monkey off our back, to be acting less out of these three poisons, and then we become more fully human. And according to Torah here, and from other sources I've heard, then we're more likely to be reborn as a human being and not as a hungry ghost or an animal or in a hell realm. And then, for those who have these three poisons subside in them, then are born in what is considered the highest of the six realms of unenlightened existence, which is that of devas. Those who lead very privileged lives of wealth and power and beauty and success, celebrity. But that too is subject to changing conditions, and we see that all the time in the Tiger Woods and the Hollywood celebrities, and how they can plummet back into the realm of hungry ghosts and hell realms and animal realms and so forth. And then he says, if you are wondering how this all comes about, you create these worlds with your minds deeply afflicted by greed, anger, and delusion, producing such bodily forms as a result. So I suppose to some people listening to this, they'll say, yeah, whatever, okay, there's that stuff about, you know, rebirth and all. But, you know, the truth is we don't know for sure. I mean, this is the teaching of this exalted, sophisticated doctrine called the Dharma, that great enlightened minds have always taught. So, since none of us knows for sure, we have our beliefs one way or another, but we don't know for sure, then we have choices as to how we use these minds, and with the possibility of consequences either way. And then finally he says, therefore, unless you extinguish these afflictions and their active expressions, you cannot be liberated. Unless you are liberated from the world of suffering of these six dispositions, there is no real peace. It doesn't mean that you have to have utterly transcended on a permanent basis these six dispositions, but that while we're caught in cravings and anger and delusion and so forth, while we're experiencing that, then can't be liberated. But that too can change in seconds, less than seconds. We traverse through these realms, transmigrate through these realms in a sesshin. Many of us have experienced this, going from anger to the states of bliss, to the deepest kind of delusive states and craving states and all. Hellish states even. So we get a little a preview, a trailer of how things work when we have stripped down our lives the way we have done so in sesshin, where everything is simplified so much, and then we get to witness the way we move through these six realms, up and down, and up again, and down again, and up again. If you want to be free from this world of suffering, first you must contemplate impermanence. Those who are born must inevitably die. Even the young are not exempt. Even the strong are in danger. Even the rich and prosperous decline. Even the noble and exalted cannot remain that way. Even a long life does not last more than 80 years or so. Thus, this world being impermanent, there is nothing enjoyable. We know that we can find plenty of things to enjoy, but of course his point is that if we are aware of the inevitability of our death, the certainty of our death and the uncertainty of the time of our death, if we carry that awareness, then certainly our ordinary sense pleasures can be tinged with a little melancholy. I hear from more and more people as they age that this awareness of the passing nature of things assumes a kind of a background tone in one's awareness. G.K. Chesterton said, "To love anything is to see it at once under the lowering clouds of danger." Hear this from people as they age and say that they say to their spouse, "Okay, who will go first?" Or if they don't say it, they think it. They wonder it. Not probably as an obsession, but from time to time. Okay. Now, it seems that we won't live forever after all. Here too, young people hear this and say, "Okay, if you say so," and then on to the next pleasure or pleasurable experience. Or But Shakespeare more or less addressed them when he said, "Golden lads and girls, all must, as chimney sweepers, come to dust." Whereas I think when people have a diagnosis of serious illness and then they find their way through it, their cancer goes into remission or something else wonderful happens where they're given more time, but in fact it's only a matter of time, isn't it? We may be able to buy a few more years, maybe a couple more decades, but it is just a matter of time. One more quote. This is from Milarepa. Milarepa is, maybe the 12th century famous Tibetan master. "All worldly pursuits have but one unavoidable and inevitable end, which is sorrow. Acquisitions end in dispersion, buildings in destruction, meetings in separation, births in death. Knowing this, one should from the very first renounce acquisition and heaping up and building and meeting, and faithful to an eminent teacher, set about realizing the truth." Back to what Toray was teaching and what hundreds of masters before him and since them have taught. The poor suffer from lack. The rich suffer from possessions. The high suffer from their high status. The low suffer from their low status. They suffer over food and clothing, suffer over wives and children, suffer over wealth, suffer over official rank. Anyway, if you don't annihilate the nature of affliction somehow and arrive on the path of liberation, even if you ascend to the rank of sovereign of a nation, great minister, deity, spirit, it is still evanescent as lightning and morning dew, lasting only for a while. For lay people, which is all of us, really, for lay people, the challenge is to live in this world of striving and achieving and acquiring houses, cars, and so forth, without getting attached to them. That's the key point, is not to try to avoid all worldly things, but to, as much as possible, to avoid getting deeply attached to them and to people, family. It's a tall order. He goes on, "When conditions meet, everything seems to exist. But when the conditions disintegrate, emptiness." This is another way of saying that everything is conditioned. All phenomena, all meetings and acquisitions and so forth are come about through causes and conditions. And when the causes and conditions do disintegrate, when they come apart, then there are no phenomena. There's emptiness. And then as a way, a common example, he says, the body is gotten through the relationship of father and mother, comes from their conditions. Solidity becomes skin, flesh, ligament, and bone. Fluidity becomes spittle, tears, pus, and blood. Heat becomes warmth and flexibility. Air becomes breath and movement. These are the way the ancients, not only in Buddhism but other traditions, the ancients saw all phenomena as consisting of the four elements of earth, water, fire, and air. And here, of course, he's relating it to our own body. Air becomes breath and movement. Heat becomes warmth and flexibility, and so forth. When these four conditions suddenly are exhausted, the body gets cold and the breath stops. There is nothing called me. At that time, this body is really not our own. It is only a temporary inn. How can we be so greedily attached to this temporary inn that we ignore eternity, that is, we ignore what is beyond change. We ignore experiencing that which is beyond change, the transcendent, what is beyond time, space, so forth. And then he gets into a really very, very basic aspect of Buddhist doctrine, which is called the conditioned arising or interdependent arising, dependent co-arising, sometimes translated as the conditional nexus or the causal nexus. I'm reading here from the Encyclopedia of Eastern Philosophy and Religion. The doctrine of conditioned arising says that all psychological and physical phenomena constituting individual existence are interdependent and mutually condition each other. This, at the same time, describes what entangles sentient beings in samsara. The chain of conditioned arising is, together with the doctrine of no self, the core teaching of all Buddhist schools. So this is sometimes called the 12-fold link of dependent co-arising. The first is ignorance, the lack of recognition. This means the lack of a recognition of the Four Noble Truths, ignorance of the suffering-ridden nature of existence. And from this comes the formations or impulses which precede actions. These can be good, bad, or neutral and are related to physical, verbal, and psychological actions. These formations or impulses condition consciousness in the next life of the individual. This consciousness re-enters another womb after the death of an individual who has not been liberated and instigates there the arising of number four, name and form, the psychological and physical factors. That is, a new empirical being constituted by the five skandhas. Which womb the consciousness chooses is determined by its qualities, which in turn depend upon the formations or impulses. The fifth of the 12 links of conditioned existence are the six bases. These are the six object realms of the senses, which present themselves to the being after its birth. And these condition the sixth, which is the sixth link, which is contact with its environment. This contact invokes the seventh, which is sensation, out of which develops craving, the eighth. Ignorance and craving lead, after the death of the individual, to the ninth, clinging, to a womb, where, number 10, a new becoming is set in motion. This is followed by birth, number 11, which again comes to an end in old age and death. The entire chain of conditions thus covers three existences. The first two relate to the previous existence. 3 to 7 relate to the conditioning of the present existence. 8 to 10 to the fruits of the present existence. And 11 to 12 to the future life. I know this is hard to absorb when you're just listening to it. It's so basic to what we're doing here going through it again. Now, back to Torre, he simplifies this quite a bit. He says, when the original mind is in the dark, it produces various activities. These are the two conditions, ignorance and volitional impulses. Those are the first two of the 12 links. As actions accumulate, they become instinctive. These are the habit forces. The parents copulate and the embryo dwells within. These are consciousness and name and form. When the body is complete and its six faculties finally developed, this is called the six media of sense. He continues through the life of an individual. Being born, yet not yet distinguishing good and bad, is called contact. After the age of 2 or 3, people already enjoy good tastes and beautiful colors. This is called sensation. After the age of 10, there is a longing for goods and sex. This is called craving. Past 15 or 16, people greedily cling to one thing after another. This is called grasping. From the age of 20, when you do your adult work without fear of wrongdoing, is called becoming. When you are doing what you do and piling up faults, the condition of your future life, for good or bad, is decided therein. This is called birth. So we are born in accordance with our and the actions of our previous life. Doing such things all your life, you get old and feeble and die. These are called the 12 causal conditions of human life. Those who are enlightened by understanding these conditions examine them, put an end to passion and affliction, and enter enlightenment. These are all techniques of the enlightened ones for entering the way. When you understand the mind darkened by ignorance and see its real nature, then ignorance becomes identical to the enlightened nature. Action is the way. Consciousness becomes the power of knowledge. Then the 12 causal conditions all accord with the right way and eventually arrive at the great realization of liberation. So different schools of Buddhism have different ways of coming to terms with this chain of samsara, this chain of dependent co-arising. In Zen, you could say, I'm not sure about this, but I'm going to say that in Zen, we go to the the ninth link, which is grasping or clinging, and we endeavor to break the chain there in our zazen. So while sitting, the whole point is to not cling to thought forms that arise as we're sitting. You could say then that Zen, in essence, is non-clinging. This is what we learn in Zen practice, certainly in Sesshin. The sooner we learn to let go of thoughts and states of mind, to not cling to them, that is, the easier we will have of the whole thing. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.